Jason Davis is joining me with Lane County Public Health. And Jason, I wanted to have you on our town today to talk about some of the COVID-19 things that have been going on in the last couple of weeks. I see we had some big spikes over the holidays.
Yeah, and we're continuing to see those spikes are now turning into what we would refer to as an upward trend. And primarily, most likely, even though we haven't gotten the sequencing results back of Omicron. You know, I think the silver lining to what we're seeing right now is the fact that we did have a little bit of time to prepare for this. You know, we first saw Omicron pop up in early November in Africa, and it was identified as a unique variant. Some of the unique characteristics of it were identified by late November. And by virtue of those characteristics, we anticipated it making its way to Oregon and causing the case surges. And so what we did sort of to prepare for that is make sure that we had adequate testing. We were coming out of the pediatric vaccine effort. And so we were short-staffed in order to be able to provide enough boosters to Lane County residents. So we turned to OHA and to FEMA and worked with them to bring clinics to Lane County, one of which actually is there in Florence. The other one that's run by OHA is out at the annex at Peace Health. And those were, you know, basically Lane County Public Health saying, you know, if we really want to batten down the hatches and prepare for this, we need help. And we just don't have the staffing to be able to do the pediatric vaccines, to be able to do the boosters, primary doses, everything all at once. And so thankfully they came through, and 3 days after the phone call, we had the annex set up, and a couple of weeks after that, we were able to get them over in Florence. So that's good news. And then our testing sites as well have we've tripled the number of testing sites. So we have testing sites now there in Florence. We have them in Junction City. We have them in Cottage Grove. And then we've effectively doubled the amount that are in the metro area as well. That just helps us kind of understand, you know, what's going on in terms of case trends and what we need to be doing. And then just a few other things that, you know, we probably could have done earlier on the pandemic. We've learned from these past surges on what's most effective. And really, it's all about making things as easy as possible for folks, both in terms of getting information, knowing what to do, knowing how to self-report if they have a at-home test kit. But one of the big changes that we've made was switching from those outbound calls that you would receive if you were a positive case, from a case investigator, kind of finding out, you know, where you've been, et cetera, to only focusing in on our most at-risk population for those outbound calls. And the rest of the population, we are referring back to our call center at 682-1380. That call center, we have case investigators there in the call center now. So when you call, if you're a positive case, let's say you're in your 50s, you're not part of an at-risk population, and you you know, you test positive for COVID, now you can call that call center. They can tell you all about the latest. They can tell you when you should be going to the hospital. They can guide you through kind of notifying those close contacts that you may have exposed inadvertently. All the things that you would normally get from a case investigator, now you get from our call center. And that allows us to handle many more folks per day, which in turn just means that our footprint gets larger. So, and, you know, going back to the cases, George, we are seeing the highest case rates that we've seen since the August Delta spike. So our highest per 100,000 case rate on a rolling 7-day average was 420. And that was August 16th, the week of August 16th. Just today, we calculated that our case per 100,000 is around 370. And we have just begun the surge. So we anticipate this latest surge being much higher than the Delta surge. Obviously, the good news is it appears as though Omicron is not causing the hospitalizations that we saw during Delta. Nevertheless, though, I think, you know, in talking with our health officer and talking with our public health sort of strategist, the one thing that we're trying to really hedge our bets against is that the fact that if we get enough people sick just by virtue of the numbers, we will have increases in hospitalizations and by virtue of that, increases in deaths. So certainly something we want to, it's worth trying to slow the spread, even though we know folks are sick and tired of COVID, hearing about COVID, getting COVID, you name it, they're tired of it. And I think you've seen the shift away from, you know, these sort of heavy-handed public health, either recommendations or mandates from a state level, to more of an individual. The onus is on the individual saying, all right, here is what you can expect from this illness. Here's how to protect your family and your community. Here are the implications if we don't protect our family or our community. And now really, let's leave this choice up to you. And that is definitely a shift. I think it's been noted nationally, but certainly one I think that's necessary as we start to fully understand just the fact that COVID is here to stay.
Now, I'm curious about this as it pertains to our vaccination clinic here in Florence. You had told me on several different occasions that the 97439 zip code is one of the highest vaccinated zip codes as far as in the county goes, and yet we've got a full-time vaccination clinic here now. What was the reason for bringing it in this area?
So a couple different things. One is you have a higher percentage of folks who are in what we would call that elder population. And even though you have fantastic vaccination rates, I was just talking with our health officer again about another subject, and that is how do we prevent hospitalizations? And so there's actually sort of an equation where you look at what does a vaccination or a booster dose or a masking strategy, et cetera, how does that help prevent hospitalization? And there's actually an equation for each of those different strategies. And by far the most effective strategy is a primary dose. One or around 400 primary doses will prevent one hospitalization. Whereas if you look at a booster dose, it's more like 2000 booster doses will prevent a hospitalization. So even though it's completely worth it to have a booster dose effort, we absolutely have to still have a presence there for those primary doses for folks who have not gotten one yet. And, you know, when you're looking at a town or an area of 9 to 10,000 people, you know, and you have 70 to 80% vaccination rates, which is fantastic. That still means you have hundreds of people who are not vaccinated, if not thousands. And those folks, you know, if we can get even 10, 15, 20, 30 of those people vaccinated, it'll make a huge difference in our overall health trends. So, you know, that's one of the reasons. The other reason is that our booster dose penetration is not where we want it to be. Overall, for Lane County as a whole, we only have about 27% of our population boosted. So we still have a ways to go in terms of that footprint with our booster doses. And also, George, you know, I think just making sure that the expectation is that we include our rural areas, including Florence, as part of our overall efforts. You know, yes, we have a great primary dose percentage out there, but we need to have a presence there all the time. That's part of good prevention. And even though you might look at it as overkill, it does establish that sort of presence that folks can come to rely on.
Now, what about the idea of the Omicron starting to wane? I've heard some people say in the next 2-3 weeks we might see that. But then again, you hear of France, there's another variant coming out. What kind of are the plans now to try to find a way to slow this down or stop this even?
Yeah. I think, you know, the plans I mentioned earlier around making sure that folks know their status and that we help our community understand the importance of slowing it down. Those are the two best strategies. Kind of understanding, you know, where the CDC has gone with their guidance, with shortening the guidance for vaccinated and boosted individuals. And just seeing the fatigue around the community, we really want to move into a harm reduction strategy. It's going to be the most effective way that we can move forward and try, as you mentioned, to slow down the cases. You know, we're not going to stop the cases. We're not going to, quote unquote, win the war with COVID, but we can slow the cases down enough to where, you know, especially with Omicron, it being not as virulent or as potent of a strain in terms of the health outcomes to offset those hospitalizations. That's kind of our overall strategy, and that comes back down to that individual responsibility of first and foremost having testing accessible, having folks be able to report their test results if they use an at-home test kit, which is incredibly important for us understanding how COVID is moving through the community, and then, you know, just making sure that folks understand the implications of the fact that if this variant, even though generally speaking, they've heard the talking point that it's not as severe. If it makes its way into an unvaccinated person, especially if that person is part of an at-risk population, it can absolutely still cause hospitalization and absolutely still cause death. We want to prevent that at all costs. You know, and it's funny because I think folks have kind of seen public health for the first time in the last couple of years, and they're surprised at how hard we work to prevent illnesses and diseases that don't always kill you. But what you don't see behind the scenes is the societal impact. There are tremendous societal impacts from even mild viruses that make their way through our community. You remember, you know, a few years ago, we had an elementary school shut down there in Florence because of influenza. That has a huge impact on those kids. We saw the impact that COVID had on shutting down schools. And just in terms of, you know, aside from school age children, on workforce, you name it, it has an impact. We want to try to lessen that impact and also, of course, preserve life. Even in, you know, individuals who have chosen not to get the vaccine, they deserve to be protected by our actions. And that's what public health is all about. We want to make that equitable. We want to try to lessen those impacts, understanding that the national and certainly our regional focus has waned in terms of COVID being our number one topic when we wake up in the morning. I think it needs to be a topic now. It needs to be part of your consideration. The same way, you know, you, George, you don't want a cavity. You don't want to pay for your dental bill or your copay if you have insurance. So what do? You wake up, you brush your teeth. Most likely you won't get a cavity by skipping a day, but you do it anyways. That's the same way we need to treat respiratory health. When you wake up in the morning, how can I prevent myself from getting sick? How can I prevent my loved ones from getting sick? It's going to be better for you as an individual. It's going to be better for your community. And it's not only about COVID. It's about influenza. It's about, you name it, the respiratory illnesses that are out there. They're worth preventing.
We've seen kind of a slight rise in the influenza aspect of it, but it's still pretty low compared to the 2019-2020 data that we had. Do we expect to see that still kind of remain a little lower than normal?
Yeah, I think we will. Influenza is driven by the same factors that COVID is driven by. It is less infectious on average than your typical COVID strain, especially Omicron. So if we're working hard to prevent COVID, by virtue of that effort, we're going to prevent at least a percentage of our overall influenza cases. We're not going to see those large-scale outbreaks quite as prevalent. And in our school-age children, you know, where we see influenza outbreaks tend to be very similar to where we've seen our COVID, our worst COVID outbreaks, and not saying worse in terms of health outcomes, but the spread, the rapid spread. So in schools and in congregate care facilities, it's those, you know, 30 to 40 people all in a room together. That's where we see spread of influenza. And, you know, within our schools, the kids are masking, there's distance protocols. And even though, you know, you might from a bystander perspective kind of say, well, you know, I don't know how much disease that's really preventing. Well, I think the influenza numbers are proof in the pudding that it is, in fact, preventing disease. Just that little twist of kind of manipulating our daily behavior can really make a difference when it comes to disease transmission. And that's what's helping us reduce our overall influenza numbers.
As far as the breakthrough numbers go, do we have an idea where Florence sits? Are we in the kind of the status quo with the county and the state?
Yes. Looking across the zip codes, I think Florence is right on par at about 35% breakthrough of our overall cases. So that's trending with the county and certainly trending with the state. And I think that we can expect that to probably continue. I think that's actually a positive number because we had anticipated that to be a little bit higher with Omicron. Now, the caveat to that with the case increases that we just seen, and this being at the very front end of the surge, and then, you know, by virtue of the holidays being right fresh behind us, we can expect to see potentially more breakthrough cases in the next couple of weeks. We're at least preparing for it. Again, though, most of those individuals don't end up in the hospital. Most of those individuals are just fine in terms of breakthrough cases. What's interesting, though, and this can be confusing for folks, is when you look at the percentage of breakthrough cases in the hospital, it remains, you know, a significant percentage. And so, you know, obviously, you know, one could be led to think that, well, the vaccine doesn't even prevent hospitalizations. But when you look at the percentage of people who are vaccinated, who don't end up in the hospital, who are part of an at-risk group, it's astounding at how many hospitalizations they really do help prevent. You know, on average, 60 to 70% of folks prevented from going to the hospital by virtue of their vaccination status.
Jason, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate you giving us the update today.
All right. Thanks, George. We'll talk to you soon.
And that's a wrap for the January 2022 edition of Our Town.